So much so that there needed to be a generation apart. And there's this lovely phrase that it may have taken one night to have gone out of Egypt, but it took 40 years to get Egypt out of Israel, out of their custom next time. Because an event where Moses also doubted that he also didn't enter the promised land, so that fell to Joshua. So this is now when we start getting to the first history book with Joshua, and he leads the Israelites into the promised land. And they conquer bits in here, and if you imagine Israel, I'm a terrible drawer. Okay, even my matchstick men don't look like matchsticks. But if you imagine, roughly, that's the sea line. You've got the Sea of Galilee, you've got River Jordan and the Dead Sea. So they very much crossed here and then took bits. So we kind of think, you know, conquered it all, but they're only sort of taking bits. And there are other, you know, people still in there and so on. And this kept happening, and they were all talking about how are they going to divvy up between the 12 tribes and all that kind of thing. But it wasn't until David's time that actually we took Jerusalem and then had a kind of central thing. Anyway, I'm leaping ahead there. God said he wanted them to have kings, so they had judges. So the closest I can say you can get to them, and this is not a great way of selling it, I know, is a bit like an Ayatollah in modern times. And rather than a king, it's someone, you know, it's a religious leader sort of leading that area. And you go through a series of judges. Surprise, surprise, good ones, bad ones. Until Israel say, look, everywhere else wants to have king, it has kings, we want one for ourselves. So they end up with getting Saul, and then Saul, surprise, surprise, mucks up, and so therefore they then have David. And there's a bit of an overlap between David being sort of anointed and before Saul is actually killed. And then in David's time, it's often seen as a golden era, and his son's time, Solomon, which is when the temple was built in Jerusalem. And you had a united kingdom, not the UK, but the United Kingdom. But after Solomon's time, there was a split. So I said there were 12 tribes. And if he wasn't just here, you had some over here in Gilead as well. So you had then a northern kingdom and a southern kingdom. And notice how Jerusalem's in the southern kingdom. So when, like, the woman of Samaria says to Samaria up here, well, you say you can only worship on the Holy Mount, that's because they're saying, well, you can't worship up there, you have to come to a different kingdom to do proper worship. So that's where all that sort of thing is coming from. So 10 tribes up there and 2 there. Slightly simplistic, because the Levites, the priests, were kind of all over as well. And then you get accounts of... the pattern is basically this. If you've got a king that... that worships God and is good to the one God, you tend to prosper and do well. And if you have a king that doesn't, you tend to not prosper and then lose battles and things like that. That's the kind of pattern that goes back and forwards. Good, bad, good, good, bad, 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 good. You know, that kind of thing. Until Assyria, you think Assyria, Syria, similar kind of area, comes and takes away the 10 tribes. And they say take away, what they would often do is take away all the key people, and then they would ship their own people in. And of course, what happened out of that is that the 10 tribes kind of lost their identity, because now it was so interbred with the Assyrians or whatever, who was an Israelite, who was an Assyrian, you know, kind of thing. So in one sense, that was lost, never to be found again. And you had the two southern kingdoms going, but a similar thing happens. This time, rather than the Assyrians, the Babylonians, so you think of Iran sort of area now. But what is slightly different here is that rather than what the Syrians did, there still remained, in a sense, a nucleus of Israeli people. One, those that had been shipped off, but two, also some that were then kept behind. But they also started to intermarry. Now, this is where you get on to, I give away all those things, where you get on to Ezra and Nehemiah, where they come back to here. Ezra starts to rebuild the Israelite community, telling them, don't intermarry, get rid of those wives, come back to being Israelites again. And then Nehemiah building up the physical fortress, in a sense, the walls of Jerusalem. And that's pretty much the story, to use that term. Now, if you look at those books, I've got up to Nehemiah. And I think the important point here to recognise is that at that point, that's pretty much the story of Israel as we have it. It goes beyond it. The Protestants, bless them, took out the, I'm saying them as if I'm not, but yeah, took out what we call the Apocrypha, and there's a bit more of the stories of the Maccabees, if you heard of Judas Maccabeus and all that kind of thing. So there is what we call an inter, sort of between Testament period that we have missing when we've taken the Apocrypha out. So I'll leave that up to you if you want to fill in at that point. But then the other books, they're not a later history. They are books that relate to the story I've already said. So you will read the Psalms and it will reflect, for example, on how God led Israel out of Egypt. Or they'll reflect on, you know, David's kingship. And then you'll get the prophets, and they dip into those history books that I talked about. So you actually read in 2 Kings, like Elijah, Elisha. So there's a prophet, and actually you can see where he is in there. So those prophets talk about either the time towards before being captured, saying, if you don't do this, this is going to happen. Or they'll talk about once they've been captured, saying, but there'll be a time when you'll be restored. That's often those sort of bits of what we do in Advent, for example, when we're looking forward, you know, to hope and promise. That's pretty much the Old Testament. Anything major there you think I should have done?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Of Israel? Mm-hmm. Past that without saying where did they come from?
The 12 tribes of Israel. The 12 tribes of Israel were Jacob's sons, with a slight complication of Joseph. Joseph had two sons, Benjamin and Manasseh, and they were, in a sense, adopted as tribes on equal footing with the other 11. So, in that sense, you had kind of 13 tribes, but never mind.
Nehemiah, the restoration.
Yeah,
you covered that.
I covered sort of Ezra and Nehemiah.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
And then New Testament. Well, you have the four Gospels, but that's it. Of course, it's about Jesus, and that's right there at the start. Because the first writings were the letters, and the oral stories may have been there. Obviously, would have been there. But the gospel was written a bit later. There isn't really kind of timeline as easy, you know, this is the story, this happened before that, other than this was written before that. But, yeah, New Testament basically about Jesus. I think that's a fair summing up. Pretty much all of it about Jesus. So that's the zooming out, and that was a big zooming out because I was trying to cover the entire Bible in however many minutes that was. Right, the Bible. Done those things. So, you can probably see from what I've just said, it was never meant to be read from Genesis 1 to Revelation 22, if it's one continuous story. So if you were to try that, what I would recommend you do, by all means, you would probably start with the Gospels and that area. If you wanted to start from the beginning, do Genesis, do Exodus, and then go on to Joshua, because if you try to start from cover to cover, most people lose their way around Numbers. You get clogged up in detail that is not really, I wouldn't say that's important for 21st century living, but I do mean that in another way. You know, all the names and numbers and all that kind of thing. So then go to Joshua and, you know, cover the history books up to 2 Kings. Because you'll find that 1 Chronicles, 2 Chronicles are in a sense sort of... yeah, they're doing the same sort of stuff, but we might touch a bit about that later. And then, you know, start looking at the epistles or whatever. So what I'm trying to say is, if you want to cover the Bible, probably best not to start from the beginning and work your way through, but to do something like what I said. And you'll get there, but it's easier to understand what the prophet's going on about if you've already got the history in your head. Now, here, remember the spectrum I said. There are some people that might disagree with this, but I say it's meant to be read literally, although some people will read it literally. Do you understand what I mean? Yeah? In other words, it's designed to be read in the writing. For example, if I wrote a diary entry, and I wrote a love letter, and I wrote a report on a crime that I had, I would hope no one in the future would read the different kind of writings, or a little personal note to myself, all in the same way, because they were never meant to be read in the same way. They have different things. So, what I want to do is to get you talking to one another. Now I've got here 10 examples, so I think roughly one per two, but I may 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 8, 9, 10, so a bit of 1, 2, 3, 4 groups of 3. Okay, so what I want you to do is just read the passage that I've got. And again, think about, it's meant to be read literally. Think about what your first impression is just reading it without thinking that. And then think about, well, which bits of the Bible did that come from? And does that change, you know, what's happened? And incidentally, we'll go on to this. Even if it's history, well, I've read history books about the Second World War, and they don't all agree with one another. So the writer still plays a part in even recording history. Okay, so... So how about I say 3 groups of 3? Do a group of 3. We do a 2, a 2, and a 2 between the 6 of you. Did you do a group of 3?
I'm not sure. Group of
2, a 2 and a 2. I'm sorry, a 3, I meant.
Yeah. I thought I'd already been banned from your group and I hadn't even started.
I think you're with Andrew.
I'm a bit short of space.
I can turn around, but
I can sort of go that way. I can't. And I've got the bit of paper. So that's, yeah, that's right.
go to anoint Jesus' body. Very early on the first day.
Yeah, exactly.
And the other two chapters, the woman had stone away from the tomb. When he looked up, he saw that the stone was very large and rolled away. As they entered the tomb, they saw a young man dressed in a white robe sitting on the right side and they were alarmed. Don't be alarmed, he said. You are the Prince of Nazareth. He has risen. He's not here. See the place where they live. Let it go and tell his disciples and read to him. He's going ahead of you to Galilee. There you will see it just as he told you. Trembling in the wilderness, the women went to half a place in the tomb and said, I'm going out because they were
excited.
Just 1 minute left. Okay. I'm afraid all we'll do is scratch the surface, but you know, if it gives you 100 to scratch deeper, then that's great. Okay, so Genesis 1. That's good. Any thoughts? Just a few words or thoughts.
I think we felt that it was a very poetic description. That it was perhaps somebody trying to describe the wonder of what was had happened, how it might have come about. I think we've got a mixture of views as to whether it should be taken literally or literally.
Yep.
I think we were being in balance with what we felt.
Thank you. I think a real nugget out there was that it was poetical.
Mm.
So that was really good. And if you were to put this in a section of the Bible, of course, where is the poetry? It's in the wisdom area of the Bible. So I think that's a really good phrase. It's not in the history part of the Bible, but let me say that it doesn't mean to say something that's not in a history part of the Bible isn't historical, and something that's in the history part of the Bible doesn't necessarily mean it's historical, but again, it can help to just sort of, when you're reading it, shape. Well, what kind of literature am I reading here? Yeah, thank you. So I suppose if you just say when we do these references, Genesis 1, so that's you know, part of the creation story. We'll be looking at this in more detail when we zoom in later. Luke 18:23. So that is where the young man sort of says, you know, well, this is I'm doing all this. So then he says, but how do I inherit eternal life? And he said, well, sell everything you got and give to the poor.
Yeah.
Thoughts?
Well, we first thought, is this a recount? Because it's come from somebody telling a story to Luke, and Luke has recounted it. So is it accurate? We don't know. But we think it's not to be taken literally, necessarily.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Parable.
Yes, it's more of a sort of, yeah, what are you going to reflect on? Rather than literally, we've all got some of the things.
Yeah. Yes. I mean, from the gospel, I think this is intended rather than to be a parable. It is intended to be an account, a recounting. But from what we might miss out of this is that Jesus said to this person, "Sell everything, give to the poor." He didn't say, "I'm saying to everyone, sell everything, give to the poor." And that's the bit that can get missed. Now, not saying, therefore, we shouldn't sell everything given to the poor. Don't get me wrong. But what I'm saying is we sometimes miss that in that account, there was a specific issue that that young man had that Jesus was trying to address.
Mm-hmm.
It's not necessarily the same issue that all of us have. So, yeah. So, in that sense, it is like a parable.
Mm-hmm.
There is a meaning there. But if we go on to Matthew 5, 1-11...
And
that's the Beatitudes.
The Beatitudes, it could be read literally and literally. Literally just as the Beatitudes, which are beautiful in their own right. But literally, it can also be seen as a massive political dig to the religious authorities at the time. That perhaps they should be living this way, and they won't.
Yeah. Yep, very good insight. Well done. I mean, in Matthew's Gospel was very much written for the Jews of the time. Now, the Beatitudes, when we look at the Gospels, you say, right, apart from in the temptation itself, we've gone through the birth narrative all the way through to the until now Jesus is ready to start teaching. And he's going to open his mouth for the first time. We've been waiting. We've had four chapters and we've been waiting to hear Jesus speak. And now we're going to hear his word. And there's a big sort of climax of that. And it's purposely laid out in a way of actually saying, here's as akin to Moses, an improved version of Moses, like that. And so as opposed to something written for a specific person, here is something. This is what the rest of the ministry is based on. You can read everything through what I'm about to say here. So if you see, Jesus said two things here, but by understanding the kind of occasion he's recorded as speaking in, they're quite different, not meanings, but you understand what I mean, impact versus...
Yeah.
Matthew 4, 6.
That was us. This was about the temptations by the devil.
Yeah.
So the Beatitudes is now sort of getting ready to go forward into his ministry. It also refers back to the Old Testament, which gives him...
It do refers back.
The devil.
Thank you, yes. Now, I covered this in the sermon, so you're doing a bit of... Brilliant. Now, the reason I point this out, sorry to come across the Bible, but... You know these calendars where you have inspirational quote of the day? One of them was, he will command his angels concerning you, and the hairs they will bear you up so that you will not dash your foot against the stone. Yeah, very inspirational until you actually consider who that quote of the day was actually quoting. So again, you know, you're to read around that on its own, you may not pick out actually that's Satan talking, albeit using scripture. So I totally move on, but I want to keep going.
Yeah,
so Job, Job 1, who had that?
Oh, yeah, we had some of that.
Okay, so that's basically where you see Satan almost like doing a wager with God, saying, Job may be faithful to you, but I bet if I can ruffle his feathers, he won't be. Okay, your thoughts on that?
Well, I took it to be more an illustration of what everybody else is questioning God for, and he's saying, you go and see if you can do better.
Yep. Do you think if we're going to push you? Do you think that actually happened?
No.
Right. I don't mean talking about building hedges, mountains.
Yes.
Job is a bunch of book about trying to understand why the suffering exists and that kind of thing. So I don't want to put you on the spot, Danny. Do you think that happened? But the point I'm trying to get through here is Job is a wisdom literature, not a history.
Yes.
So is that the word of God telling us that the reason why we have suffering is because the devil's playing poker over our souls or something like that, which a lot of that kind of still exists through particularly medieval theology. But yes, it's a wisdom literature as opposed to history. Doesn't mean to say there's nothing historical about it. I'm not going to cast an opinion about that, but it's good to be aware of what we're reading. 2 Kings 12, who had that?
Yeah.
So that is very much about Jehu and
Josh.
Yeah, and rebuilt, so just decorate the temple, that kind of thing. Yeah.
I struggled with it a bit in that Josh asked for the temple to be rebuilt, and Jehu was instructed that all the money collected over a period of about 23 years should be used for rebuilding the temple, and it wasn't rebuilt. So I don't know, I imagine that's a literal historical fact, or one that isn't a historical fact. Are we talking about different timelines? And
yeah, and what is 2 Kings? Which bit of the Bible are we talking of here? Is that wisdom literature? Or is that history?
History.
That's history. So here, we can read it more as a piece of historical writing. We still ask the questions, though. Has the person retold that history in a way? Because you can then, we'll look at where we'll compare with Chronicles in a moment. But yes, look at that more history. Thank you. Judges, too, who had that?
We did.
Yeah. Basically, this is God getting tough with those who turn to other religions.
Yeah.
When they did turn away to Baal and the other gods, whatever they did in the battle, however they were attacked, they came off worse every time.
Yeah.
The question is, though, is who wrote it?
Yes.
Was it written by a male reader or a mirror reader? Because from my point of view, when you read it, it actually reads like a newspaper article rather than actually a piece of history.
Yeah.
It uses words like pouring after other gods and they bowed down and abandoned the Lord and served the Baals of Ashtaroth. And you think, actually, who's writing this? It's a very emotive language.
Yes. But I'm glad you're asking the question, who's writing this, because that is one of the things we need to be asking to dig a bit deeper in to understand what we're reading.
I mean, it's almost certainly a report of what happened,
yes,
but it's biased from a point of view of the person who wrote it.
It is
well,
like
it
me.
It would always be like Moses to have a really biased view of what was happening with the rest of the Jews.
Yeah. With my knowledge I understand that this was probably written by the priests who wanted people to come back to worship God, and so they will write it in a way that makes it much more emotive than maybe it would read otherwise.
But But it's a good point. It'd be like me giving you an article from the Mail or the Mirror or something, but cut out and not telling you where it's from, and then expect, well, you've just got to take it at face value without any further questions. This is just trying to understand a bit deeper. Doesn't mean it's right, wrong, it's just deepening our understanding. Revelation 13.
Oh, yes, it's us.
Sorry.
This is it. Yeah, it's well, interesting.
Yeah. Junctions heard me talk about this. But this is, you know, the beast, like the seven heads and so on. Yeah.
Ten.
Ten.
What was it, ten horns?
Ten horns.
Yeah.
Well, one would hope it's not literal.
Yeah. Revelation 13. Well, if it's still on the website, listen to talk that some strange person gave on it. But yes, that's a particular style of writing, and that we'll be looking at particularly in the last session of the tour of the Bible. One just for itself, but yes, not intended to be read literally. It's intended to be code, basically, because the writer was in pretty much a lot of trouble as he was anyway at the time. That was. Psalm 109, we have that. Okay, and that basically is saying, you know, what this person to be dead and all his children to be dead and basically
to be eradicated from history. Yeah.
Absolutely.
I don't think that's literal. It says on the bottom of the Bible that it says it's a call for God to judge the wicked from David. He's sort of asking God to do that, but he doesn't understand. I mean, there's a bit where it says, may his children be fatherless and his wife to be a widow, and elsewhere in the Bible it says that you're supposed to love the widows and the orphans, whereas this is saying you're not supposed to even talk to them.
Yeah. No. Well, I just want to pick up, it was a bit like saying here about Jesus talking to, it wasn't a parable. I mean, you could take it literally, but it's then the understanding of what was Jesus meaning, what do you mean for everyone? I think you could take this fairly literally, but it's remembering that it's more wisdom literature, and the Psalms is the most human part of the Bible. This is a person going through a time, because obviously I sense that he feels hard done by this person, and he's saying, you know, God, I want you to do away with them. Well, I think you can take that at face value, but that's not saying God is wanting to do away with them. So just because we read it in the Bible is not saying that is God saying, I want him done away with.
It's not
and
a very good Christian model
of
turning the other cheek either, is it?
Yeah. Well, in fairness to the writer of the Psalms here, Jesus hadn't said that by then. But you know, sometimes often we get to, when we read the Psalms in daily prayer, we have bits in brackets which you can leave out, the bits that we don't. And I love Psalm 139, but just before the end, all of a sudden it turns a bit nasty. But we often miss that bit out. But you know, put it this way. However great you feel, however sad you feel, angry you feel, you're not the first human. And this is a collection of writing that's our history. And you can read the Psalms and know you're not alone. In fact, someone has gone there deeper than you. But read it and understanding that that is what you're reading. You're not saying that that is what God is saying he wants to happen. And then finally, Mark. Mark 16, so the resurrection witness.
Well, it's a gospel, so it's a narrative of a sequence of events that happened.
Yes, so I think here you could pretty much say it is intended to be written as a history, a bit of history. So unlike you would read it like the person's response in a psalm, here it isn't just a fable, a fairy tale or something. It is intended to to be read as a historical event.
Yeah.
Which is pretty good for the resurrection, otherwise, thank you. Yes. But you see that just by dipping into different bits of the Bible, you know, if we read the whole Bible in the same way, we're going to come a proper sooner or later by sticking to whichever one of those lines we take. So just sort of be aware of that. Now, can we just do a quick show of hands for tea and coffee for when we have a break? So if you had, if you'd like a tea... 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, up to my hand, up 10, 13, 10. And coffees?
It's instant coffee, I don't know if that makes a difference.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9.
Can I just have a glass of water?
A glass of water?
No, that wasn't on the list. Sorry.
Yeah. Caffeine free.
So water.
Hot chocolate?
Yeah. Okay.
Right. The Bible is a human book reflecting upon God's revelation. It's not like what the Muslims would say, that the human didn't have a part to play in it. You know, Muhammad was illiterate and it was dictated, and he didn't even know what the symbols meant that he was writing. Christianity does not take that view. Well, you have a spectrum of views, as I've said, but you know, pretty much everyone understands that a human took part, you know, humanity took part in the process, and indeed you do when you read it. So, what I wanted to try draw you a picture of is that, again, terrible drawing, but also this is almost impossible to draw. There is kind of God outside of time, whatever that means, but not and let's say God is sort of radiating his, you know, and sometimes when God is being God, we have, let's call it a line, because we have history. That's happened, the here's now, that's going to happen in the future. And sometimes God doing what God does actually touches upon our timeline, our human timeline. And that we will call revelation. Now, what humans do then is that, let's say, here I am, told you don't look like mastics. I'm at this point, and I'm witnessing what God is doing. So God has revealed himself, but then I am the one that's witnessing. I can't take myself out of that witness. You see what I'm saying here? God has not bypassed my brain. It is my brain that is interpreting, grappling with what did I just encounter or whatever. So it is a human process that can happen. And then, by the way, if I'm going to recount it to others, I can only recount it using human symbols, words, to encounter to others. So again, there's a human person. And then the person who I've recounted it to only hears it using a brain and in the human process. Whatever. So whilst when I'm just saying that it's a human book, don't get me wrong, it's not like I just think it's humans made it up, that God is not sort of part of the picture. But the human process is also part of the picture. And the great thing about the Bible is that someone witnessed something there, and then someone else witnessed something there, and over time we build up further layers and layers and layers, and it gets deeper and deeper and deeper until we've, you know, reached in. So, like I said in one of the sermons, imagine you're a scientist and you say, I'm not going to listen to any other scientists, I'm going to start from the beginning myself. That would be crazy. You actually put what you discover in the context of what other scientists have already discovered. Maybe you can start on a further advanced point. So the Bible is a great way of capturing what people have witnessed God doing and over time.
Stephen, I've got a slight problem with that, because that seems to... Okay, people are writing down their experiences, their revelation, if you like, but people are fallible and they make mistakes and they forget things. And is that slightly saying that there's bits of the Bible that are flawed because of that?
And that to me is a slightly difficult concept to understand, because I'm not a literalist necessarily, but you kind of accept that what's in the Bible is true and it's literal, and then slightly sows a seed of doubt, and that is, okay, that's somebody's interpretation or somebody's memory, and then you think, well, there could be all sorts of scope for error, for somebody putting their own stamp on it for all sorts of reasons, and that's just the sort of road I'm a bit uncomfortable going down, quite honestly.
Yep, that's fine. And I said at the beginning, some of this may challenge me, be comfortable, and that's fine. But even if I said to you, okay, let's take an Islam line and say that humans didn't have a part to play in it.
Mm.
When you
sure.
read it, a human playing a part in interpreting it. Do you understand that?
Yes.
Even if you
yeah.
read the Quran, you would be reading it from the 21st century, European perspective, and you are playing. You cannot, in my view, completely do away with the human element.
Mm.
Does that mean things can be taken? Well,
yeah.
is that why some people say Jesus is coming on the 24th of April 1928, and then he doesn't?
Mm. Yeah, and I can see that.
So I think the Bible can be misinterpreted, if I'm honest.
Mm.
I think you can go to church and two people say, I feel God saying this, and another person says, I feel God saying that.
Mm.
Can he be contradicting himself, or is it the human process that could possibly still trying to work out God's revelation in that sense? I'm not trying to make you feel uncomfortable, but I'm just...
No, you're not. It's something that occurred to me before. You're not the first person that said that.
Yeah.
But
remember, I'm saying from a fairly central perspective.
Mm.
There'll be people both ways that disagree with me
yes.
for two different reasons.
Yes, yeah, yeah, yeah.
And some of this may make you more uncomfortable, I'm sorry about that, but I'm offering this.
Yeah.
It's up to you. But it's also been edited some many times. And you asked me earlier about who wrote Genesis. Well, unfortunately, we don't sort of have, but here's Mr. Genesis, and he wrote it, and there we go. It has been edited. And when we edit things, well, let me actually give you some. So, Old Testament, Book of 1 Kings, at the end of chapter 11. As for the other events of Solomon's reign, all he did and the wisdom he displayed, are they not written in the Book of the Annals of Solomon, which we don't have. That's a fine copy. There's an evidence, there's an editor, there's more information that editor didn't put in. You see? Jesus performed many other signs in the presence of his disciples, which are not recorded in this book, the end of John. That person had to make a decision. I'm putting this one in, but I'm not putting that one in. It's a human process. Because We are humans. We don't have God's brain of knowing everything in that way.
Can I just insert? I'm going to guess that there's probably at least four different versions of the Bible being used this evening by different people. Which is the right one? Because they've all been edited by somebody in order to interpret three or four different languages into one language, which we now use. And unless everybody's going to learn historic Aramaic and biblical Greek and read it in the original, everything we read is an interpretation.
And even if you read it in the original, you're only going on what someone's saying you, and Macarius means this. And so it's even more complex than that. But another thing for John's Gospel, these are written that you may believe. There's, this is persuasive writing.
Can I just say, is that not where faith comes in? Because if your faith is enough, I could say, God put me in a prayer group in Cambridge where they introduced me to a life application Bible, which I haven't heard of. I had every other version, but not this.
Yeah.
This is the one that has helped me in my life.
Absolutely. And the richness of that is that that may, you know, that'd be true for you, Jim, but someone else needs something different.
Version.
Whereas
exactly.
if there was just a non-human thing and there is only one interpretation, you can't even use the word interpretation if you can take human process out of it. There's only one
revelation.
Then I'm sorry, your one didn't fit in with that, or everyone else has had to fit in with that. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah.
The richness of it actually got far greater than all of this human process. And I think he's used the human process for a reason. It was started out as all stories, which are then written, edited, and all these changes occurred in a certain time and place. So they're all shaped by when they were written, who they were written by, and all that kind of thing. And as I've just said, it's also interpreted when we encounter it. Even if we hear a direct word from God, we still have to use a human process to turn that into action. And it captures a part of a trajectory towards understanding God and ourselves. And to try and... Now, again, there will be a side of this perspective that will say, basically, it's not written in the Bible, that's it's not in it, whatever. But, you then sort of say, well, what does that tell me about what television programme I should read? Because television doesn't appear in the Bible. That's a terrible example, by the way. But what I'm saying is it's richer than that, because over time, people discover... People might have thought God was saying this, or then they thought that. And you can map the trajectory that's kind of going on. And, well, was Genesis an eyewitness account? No, because man wasn't even created until then. So, Bible's got to start at some point on this journey, and obviously the Bible stops at some point on this journey. So you need to make a decision. Does the Bible, for me... restricted to that, or does it give me the fundamental blueprint where actually I can make a decision now in the 21st century because I can see what the Bible as a whole is saying? So again, if you go down a literal point, I can't, as soon as I venture outside of that boundary, I'm in trouble. Or you take sort of the overall viewpoint. Now we're going to have an activity, at which point you also can have your tea, coffee, and cheesecake with cream if you want that. Now I've got three examples, but I can split you up into six groups. So what I've got here is two Bible references. Have a look at that. And just see if you can notice a trajectory going on between them. Do you understand what I'm saying here? Okay. So, which direction is it going? So, if in the which direction it travels? So, if in the first one it says, "Well, this is that," but I'll give you the obvious one. Like I said in the sermon about nine for an eye, two for a tooth. How the direction of travel was going from where you can have retribution, but stick to the level that you were harmed by. But the trajectory, Jesus says, but offer the other cheek. You see, there's a movement going there. Okay. Can you sort yourselves into groups? I'm giving this very roughly rather than that. And maybe one group at a time, go and help yourself to professionals.
You're the winner.
I want that with Galatians.
Well, roughly.
Please come and
Right, I think these are coming out differently. Any hands up with coffees because they're coming through first. So. There's one there.
21
plus 6. Whatever it is. Sugar is down at the front table. If you want sugar and you drink.
We're only going to give a few minutes to this. It's not that in depth. You just see the trajectory.
Slaves are free. We are all the ones Christ. So, but that's saying all people who are going to celebrate Passover.
Coffee again.
Do with this.
Passover is a journey from being circumcised to making a choice between that. You're saying it doesn't matter either way.
I'm sorry, I need
to
Thank you. Okay, 1 minute. I need a black coffee then.
An angel sighting what? Which version? What version of Amplitude is that? I know it's the Amplitude.
So the angle is
NIV.
Sorry,
yeah.
So it's the Lord's angel.
Yeah, no. NIV is good. NIV is good. I've been IV. It's a little bit of data. The good news is a paraphrase, so it doesn't actually. Whereas the NLEV is, and to some extent the RSV, the revised standard, but the RSV has been replaced by the NRSV, the new revised standard.
Yeah,
yeah. The other thing is, 25 years ago now, I use.
So one version
is
saying. The
and they translate it as close as they can to the original, and then try to arrange the words in sensible English sentences. NIV is of that type. I'm T. That's right, yeah, and then they have a definitely against the door post. No, that's the New Testament.
Squeeze past.
Is that the one we're in? Well, I'm going to finish this. We can open all the
windows. Oh, no,
This is the law.
Yes.
Oh,
I'm not sure if you're going to be able to do that.
Okay, so maybe the cheese thing go out twice and just continue. I'm just conscious of time and we've got a good piece of work to do beyond this. So okay, so did you both have the I haven't got a copy of what I've given you. Okay. Can we listen please? Thank you. So what's the key difference there? The
first one was it was written as if the instruction was coming from the anger of the Lord.
Yep.
And the second one was the same activity, but the
perspective
was that it was Satan who was
giving the instruction. Thank you. So there's some anger involved, and... Sorry, Anthony, but one person's interpreted seeing that anger as saying, that's from God, and another person has interpreted what they've seen as saying that is from Satan. Now, what you probably get is trajectory. Is that the? Sorry, remind me. You had Chronicles and
Samuel.
Samuel would have been the earlier one. So that would have been the one from the Lord. Okay. The Chronicles. That's writing about the times that's happened then. This person or people are writing from the perspective of having been shipped off to Babylon. By this point, they have witness quite a lot of evil in the process of that. By this point, the Israelites have started to kind of think, is this all from God, or is there some other force, something else coming into play here? So now they're interpreting that anger as not being from God, but being from the source of not so nice forces, from Satan. So there's a trajectory here, going from, you know, God as a vengeful, whatever, God or whatever, into one saying, but actually my experience of God isn't like that, but I've still got to explain that. So there's a trajectory here about understanding about God in terms of anger. Okay? I know I'm not trying to go further into that, but you just touch on the surface and see that. John, what would your group look at?
Circumcision.
Oh, yep. So, and who else? Yep, yes. There's two groups. So you've had Exodus,
that's all.
And then Paul writing about it. So what did you notice?
In the Old Testament, you can't celebrate Passover unless you're circumcised. And then Paul says, but there is no circumcision, or actually, being circumcised or uncircumcised actually isn't important.
How controversial can I be, Phil?
Have I not been controversial tonight already?
Is that saying then that Jesus' circumcision was of no consequence?
He didn't have any choice, though, did he?
He didn't, no.
Paul might have argued that Jesus hadn't died on the cross for his sins, by the way. Okay, just to give you a simple answer to get out of that one for now. But, yeah. Okay, so you see a trajectory there of only a certain people, and you've got to go through a certain act to do it towards grace, and all can be included. And I know you can go more deeper.
No, I just wanted to make one comment.
Yeah.
I mean, the act of circumcision defines whether or not you were a Jew in the Old Testament. In the same way, the act of baptism defines whether or not you're a Christian today. Would Paul now write today, you may be baptised or not baptised?
Yes.
Are we taking things out of context and in context?
If I tell you what that passage, what I think it can also show for us today, you know where I said where we continue to use it today? Paul fought and fought and fought against people who basically said, but it says this in Scripture. That's what he was fighting against. People, rather than you still see it there, of course, they only talking about what we're looking at the Old Testament. It was that. and said, but in there, in Scripture, it says, you said about Passover, you've got to be circumcised. And if you come away from that, you're not being scriptural. That can't be from God. That can't be from God. You see what I'm...
Wasn't there also the problem of excluding the Gentiles if they insisted on circumcision?
Yeah, absolutely. But Paul is
and he was trying to unify the church.
Yes,
moving forward.
Absolutely. By Paul doing that, by Peter with the vision of, you know, the blank sheet with the unclean animals, gives us the blueprint that actually we're not stuck in Scripture, but we move beyond Scripture as they understood it, because obviously the event wasn't Scripture for themselves at that point.
Yes.
It was the same thing, actually. Paul was speaking mostly to the Gentiles.
Mm. Yeah.
Not to Jews.
Mm. Absolutely. Mm.
Yeah. But actually, in the Bible, when he talks about the circumcision, he does say quite clearly that he is a... Jesus, I've got a covenant.
Yes.
Then he says a covenant to last forever, because I've read it today. But actually, in that particular passage, and we've got to think then that that person's going to have write down what they think they have heard God saying. Didn't quite know the nature of God even meant it that way, because he changed it when Jesus came around and changed the covenant.
I'll have it later, thanks, Michael. Yeah, I wouldn't necessarily go as far to say as maybe in the bits of the Old Testament they didn't quite understand what God was saying. Would it? Maybe God was saying something for a time, but that doesn't mean to say, just like Jesus said to that young man, sell everything, he wasn't saying it to everyone for eternity. Maybe God was saying something and it was understood, but it wasn't meant for eternity. You understand
what I mean? Well, but there it does say literally for eternity.
Yeah.
Until the end of the
years,
basically.
Yeah. I haven't got time to go into the one, but I will. We'll chat about that one. So, in the other one,
we had our
Hosea and two kings,
and someone else would have had
two kings.
Yeah. So, what did you notice?
Bloodshed
by Jehu.
And then in the verse by Hosea, it does basically say that actually, although Jehu thought he was acting with God's backing by murdering all those people, in fact, he didn't have God's backing whatsoever, because God end up doing a vengeance on him for all the bloodshed that he did during
Absolutely.
His reign.
So again, we go back to this point, you know, it's a bit troubling having a human process, but here Jehu thinks God is saying, you know, kill some of them, the wife Jezebel, all their descendants. And then if you read on, even people just being polite to them, saying, oh, where are you off to? And come with me, and then slaughters all them, and believes it's from God. Whereas later on, in that gain, that trajectory is reinterpreting that, saying, "Not the God I'm going to understand." In terms of, but God doesn't change. What I'm saying is, though, because humans, again, you can look back and reflect on that. You've got a bigger perspective the further into the future you go. Humans can change. Humans can. Think, actually, did we interpret that correctly then? And that's exactly what is going on there. You've got two interpretations going on. So the further you go into the future, the more saying, actually, does God ask people to wipe out whole families? Because there are accounts, and people get stuck with this. I'm not going to worship a God that tells people to wipe out a whole community. But that's how those people earlier on have interpreted that. But there's an example of people later on thinking...
Isn't that a little bit... I'm sorry, we had your sermon the other day about King Josiah.
countryside.
Yeah.
Yes, I.
Yeah.
And what you were describing about him going around slaughtering all these other prophets and
yes,
religions.
Prostitutes and yeah.
Isn't that a bit like ISIS?
Yeah.
And it struck me at the time. It's just.
I will touch upon this at the next session,
okay.
Because whilst we're not doing that bit, we are talking about what Israelites are trying to learn, and that, so we'll touch upon that next time. Right, we've moved up. So, I am going to. These I'm not going to talk about, but you've got them so that you can use these. Questions I might ask about a text. What comes before it? What comes after it? Are there any action or phrase or idea that I've seen before? Are there parallels within the Bible? Are there parallels outside of the Bible? This one's important. We often do not consider. Lots of Pauline writings. Where he's at his most dynamic is where he's using the culture of his time, but the bits where he differs from the culture are the bits to hone in on. And then we treat it as all the same. What is happening within the text? What new perspective is emerging? That's a key word as well. What new ideas are being presented? What sense is being heightened? Other questions to ask. Why did people write this down in the first place? Why did this passage endure? Why is it still around thousands of years later? Why do people protect and preserve this text, often with their own lives? What does this text teach us about what it means to be alive here in this world? What is it that was true for the people that wrote and edited this text, but is true for us now? How does this story help me to understand my story? So the whole number of questions there now that I just kind of leave with you for, when you look at a passage. What is the context of the text? What is it saying about God? What is it saying about humans? How might this text read now? Where is the trajectory heading? What is it saying about God now? What is it saying about us now? What is it saying about me now? These questions are asked, like, for example, where Hosea is reinterpreted the event. These are the same questions. So what the Bible does for me, it actually gives us good reason. If within the Bible, within Scripture, we're doing this, then it gives us permission to do this now. So, zooming in. Oh no, not for 5 minutes. Well, let me just look at that really quickly. We won't be able to go into the depth. What? Can you tell me, basically, what did God create on... First off, you would notice Genesis, by the way, is that... the Bible starts with two creation accounts. It's not the only two in the Bible, by the way, but it starts with two. And if I ask the question, actually, was man created first or last?
No.
Anyone want to say first?
No.
Okay, the answer to that question was, well, in the first, in Genesis 1, he was created last. Genesis 2, the second creation account, is created first. So, again, I know that may be troubling for some, but I think partly why the editors including two there is it's a way of the editor saying this isn't an eyewitness account that I'm recording here. These are stories that have lived with us. In fact, the first Genesis account is the later one. It's one written whilst the Israelites were in Babylon. Okay, whereas the Genesis 2 is a much earlier source. But why then do it? Well, okay, what did God create on day one?
Light.
Light, thank you. Day two.
water.
Yeah, separate the sky and water. Yep, three.
Vegetation.
Yep. So land, plants. Day four.
Birds.
Not yet.
No, vegetation.
Day five.
Vegetation.
No, this is key, number four.
Fishes.
No, sun, moon.
Stars.
Sun,
moon.
Ah.
moon, stars. That's a good point. Six.
Fish.
No, that's five.
But yeah, it's plant vegetation, plants, and so
forth. Day six, the last day of creation.
Oh,
day
human
six.
Being.
Human
yes.
Human being. Sorry. Day six, sorry.
Yes. And then you had seven, the Sabbath.
Yeah.
Excellent point, Emma. The sun, how about the light?
Where did the light come from then?
Because this is not a historical eyewitness account. Okay. Well, you could interpret that. Or you could say that the Israelites were in Babylon and they were amongst a culture in which a part of that culture, the god, the sun was a god, the moon was a god, the stars were gods. This account relegates the sun and the moon to a created aspect. So in a sense, the light of God pre-exists. A part of the created order. If you go right to the other end of the Bible, Revelation, there'll be neither no need for sun or moon, for God will be their light. So you don't need the sun for the light. We don't need to be worshipping the sun. So what you're seeing, when that question was said, what other writings are outside of the Bible, these are the important ones, because what are the theological points that someone is trying to make out of this? And do you notice how it's structured? Because again, it is a human writing, so humans have got to do something. So you've got to structure it. Light, sun and stars. Sky, birds. Land and plants, humans. Can you see the kind of structure there? Now, what I will give to you before you leave, not to read now, and you can bin it if you want anyway, but I'm going to give you... You might do when you see it. I'm going to give you one of the creation accounts from Babylon. So that you can actually see that the person, people, who wrote this, what was the environment that they were in. And if I share with you... something, I don't know where I've written it down, but you had the Enuma Elish, but the big kind of thing, there are a number of gods, polytheism was, the number of gods, all fighting each other, they were getting knackered, they were getting hungry, so humans were created in order to feed them. So that's the story. What is the theological point here? God feeds the humans. It turns it on its head. We weren't there to God needed something. God has provided something. That's the theological point. The fact that God spake and it happened. And God is one, holistic. Happens. The fact that God said, let us make man and humans in our own image. We are also not just there as their bit to do things for them, we are at the pinnacle of creation. And so on. When you're reading stuff, is the question, what's the theology? What's the theological point? And sometimes we say, well, is it history? And I'm not saying yes or no, but sometimes we then miss the point as to why these were written in the first place. I know I've rushed over that because we only had 5 seconds, but the key parts to it is that one God has unity, power over creation. God has concern for human welfare. That was
big revelation at the point, you know, to Israelites at that time. If you think that God has evicted you from your own lands and all that kind of thing, the world was created in a state of harmony. So animals didn't eat other animals, were vegetarians at that point. Humanity is God's image bearer who represents him on earth. Okay, so these are the key theological points out of reading, but I'll let you read for yourself. And if you want me to email stuff to you, you know, of other accounts going on, you know, the Marduk, the gods, and all that kind of thing, and then you can actually see in context what this is trying to say. Which, of course, we lose 21st century England because we're not generally aware of those things. Now, it is 9 o'clock, so but I have promised questions, so I'm going to leave it like this. If you've had enough, and I don't blame you, feel free to go. If you want to ask questions, I am here.
Can I just say, Stephen, actually,
yeah.
It has been an absolutely fascinating evening and hugely enlightening. Thank you very, very much.
My final point is, some of this may be disturbing because you've not considered things like that way before, whatever. But what I've told you is some stuff that I learned in my training to become a priest, and Bill would have learned, and Yvonne would have learned, and all that kind of thing. And it's trying to give you the meat rather than us pre-digesting it for you, and you can all sit there comfortably. I'm not trying to make you uncomfortable, but I'm trying to give you something at a bit more of a level, and that will be uncomfortable because it may not be something to before. I'm not aiming to make you uncomfortable, but let's work with this together.
Are you passing over your
yes.
piece of paper you were wanting?